Welcome to Break the Chains, America's top radio source of information for people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction and those who love them. And now, the host of Break the Chains, Gwen Cardin.
Dr. Sylvester Sciocca, known by most people as Dr. Skip, earned accolades and riches as a successful, driven, and brilliant graduate of Harvard Medical School. He eventually became physician to some of the biggest rock bands in the world, including Bon Jovi and Def Leppard. For years, he reveled in wealth and glamour. He jet-setted across the U.S. He belonged to the finest country clubs, and he lived in a California mansion. But then he became addicted to Vicodin and to alcohol. That led to the disintegration of his cushy, extravagant life, and he found himself stripped of his license to practice medicine, broke, homeless, shunned by his beloved wife and four children, and working in a sandwich shop, a job from which he got fired. At one point, he was taking 150 Vicodin a day. Yes, I said that right, a day, and he was drinking massive amounts of alcohol. After finally getting sober and enduring many years of battling the bureaucracy in California in a fruitless bid to get his medical license back, he moved to Rhode Island, and there they did eventually reinstate his license, and he now works in the addiction medicine field as director of medical-assisted recovery in Warwick, Rhode Island. We're going to spend the entire hour today with Dr. Skip, and he's going to detail his journey from Harvard to hell and back, which also happens to be the title of his new book. Welcome to the show, Dr. Skip.
Well, thank you, Gwen. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let me begin by asking you this question. Why did you write this book?
Two main reasons. First, there are many faces of addiction, and some of the ones are more commonly thought of than others, and I certainly didn't have the most common face of addiction, but in the end, addiction to alcohol and or drugs or both leads just about all of us either to death or darn close, and I wanted to show that I'm just one of many faces of addiction who was able to carry it off till he was 52, but that didn't make me any different from the final fall. And the second and probably more important reason I wanted to write the book was, although I didn't realize it at the time, once I finally got on top of the addiction, and I don't think I'm ever cured of it naturally, but now some 13 years later, I find that there is enormous joy in recovery, something which I don't think people who are struggling to stop really understand. It doesn't look like being normal is very much fun when you're trying to beat the addiction and everybody's down on you that knows you and loves you, but bottom line is when you finally let go and get better, you actually experience more joy than you ever did at your highest moments.
That is a wonderful message, and I hope that people who need to hear that are listening today. Let's move forward a little bit. I'd like you to tell listeners about your early background. I mean, I read in your book, those were pretty heady days where fame and fortune befell you in what seemed like almost a magical fashion. What was it like before you got involved?
I was very fortunate. I was born to a middle-class family in Brockton, Massachusetts, a working town, my family was wonderful. I never saw drinking or drugs in the family. My grandparents, who were immigrants on my father's side, were hardworking and had more money than most people in the little ghetto in which we lived, but we were basically middle-class. I happened to be fortunate in that I loved school, and I started to do very well at school. I was a big guy. I had a silly name, Sylvester. I got teased a lot, and I used to get beaten up by older, smaller kids, and I couldn't understand why. I guess it's because I was being a smart aleck in school. I really, all the way through grammar school, it was very easy for me to go to school. And the reason I mention that is football became a very important part to me when I got to high school. I had done very well in Brockton, graduated at the top of the class, and then went on to Boston College High School, which is a Jesuit high school in Boston. It was a bit challenging, but that became a very easy target for me. I also wanted to play football, and the combination of getting pretty much all A's through high school and becoming the co-captain of the football team and playing pretty well allowed me a chance to visit a lot of Ivy League schools, I essentially applied to a bunch of them, and even a couple of schools outside of the Ivy League that were eager for me to play football for them, and eventually ended up trying out for getting into Harvard. I chose Harvard, went there. Again, I had to start my football career all over again, but by the end of the time at Harvard College, not only was I doing very, very well in studies, but I had become a pretty good member of the football team. I actually, my last year, garnered one vote for the Heisman Trophy. Now, anybody who knows about the Heisman Trophy vote, as the best college football player in America, knows that the winner gets thousands of votes, and I got one third place vote, but bottom line is I did get it. I also received that was a very kind sports writer. I also received was not drafted by the NFL, but I got a letter asking me to come try out for the Chicago Bears. And if I made the team, they were going to sign me, with a $5,000 bonus. And to put it in perspective, that's at a time when the famous Joe Namath had been made $400,000 bonus. So I wasn't a great football player, but I was good enough to at least be asked to try out for the NFL. At the same time, because of a lot of accomplishments in college, I was accepted to Harvard Medical School. I decided to go to Harvard Medical School instead of going and trying out for the NFL. I'm not sure that was the right decision at the time. I never would have made the team, but it would have been fun to have been flattened by some really good pros. But in any event, I went to medical school, and for the first time in my life, I didn't really grasp the situation. I was one child among 99 other adults. I didn't realize it until midway through my first year at Harvard Medical School. I had been accepted. I had certainly done well enough in terms of all the studies and all the preparation for it. But that all had come easily to me. I went to Harvard Medical School. They began a pass-fail system that year, and my first sort of immature, and I think immaturity and addiction go hand, immaturity and addiction can go hand in hand, and we can talk about that later if we have time. But basically, I continued to try to lead a pretty leisurely lifestyle, and I got all the way through my first year at the medical school at Harvard with thinking I was doing okay, but since they weren't putting grades on exams, I had no idea how badly I was doing. It was also the summer when the Boston Red Sox had a guy named Carl Yastrzemski, and they were trying to run for the pennant. Fenway Park is very close to Harvard Medical School. I used to leave my anatomy class with serious students and go watch the Red Sox. Took the thing too lightly. Did fall in love with the most beautiful woman I'd ever met, and decided to marry her at the end of that first year. And the day before I was leaving to go home and to get married, I got a call from the dean, who called me over to his office and said, "Well, Skip, I got some bad news for you. I don't know what you're doing tomorrow." I said, "Well, I'm getting married." And he said, "Well, you didn't pass your first year." And so for the first time in my life, I was really handed a reality sandwich. He said, "Well, we should have, told you perhaps, been in more contact with you during the year, but you must have known you weren't doing well." I said, "Yes, I didn't think I was doing very well, but I didn't think I'd failed." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Why don't you go and have a good wedding if you can, and come back and see us after your honeymoon, and we're going to test you and see if you can stay here." First evidence of my addiction, I think, popped up there. Like any good incipient addict, I went home, was pretty sick to my stomach, and thought, what am I going to do with this horrible news? And my poor wife, who had thought she was, marrying a prize, I couldn't very well tell her. And so I did what all good addicts do, and that's lie. I ignored it, didn't mention it, went down to Rhode Island, married my wife, and took off for a 10-day honeymoon, which, needless to say, wasn't as good as it might have been. The whole time I was in the honeymoon, I thought, well, I'll tell her tomorrow. And tomorrow never came, certainly not for 3 or 4 months. So I flew back. We got back into Boston. I told my wife that I was going to go do some research at the medical school in between my first and second year. And I spent that first week back from the honeymoon being examined by a whole flock of doctors trying to see whether or not I was crazy or, whatever the problem was. Of course, I lied about doing any drinking or drugging. And at that point, I really sort of did do sporadic drinking and occasional drugging if there was some amphetamine around to study or something like that. But it hadn't controlled my life yet, except, of course, my immaturity and my lack of lack of study had really set me back. So I was starting to, this is the first time in my life I'd really failed at anything, and I was lost. After a week's worth of pretty much day-long exams, I got called back into the office, and I was told that I guess I was smart enough to stay. I had scored highly enough that they weren't going to just bounce me, but that there was a very good medical school in North Carolina that would accept me as a second-year student along with some special tutoring if I wanted to go down in North Carolina. I immediately took umbrage at that and thought, heck, I can do the medical school again, and I repeated my first year. Bottom line is, I started to study, I got better, and I fell in love with surgery. All of a sudden, I grew up in a hurry in terms of my career, and I started acting much more like an adult, although I will say that I occasionally drank, and I, you know, would occasionally do what some college students would do and smoke a little marijuana, take a little amphetamine. But bottom line, I got much more serious, fell in love with surgery, wanted to be the world's greatest gallbladder surgeon. I loved the right upper quadrant where your gallbladder is hidden under your liver. I wanted to, if I could take those out for the rest of my life, I didn't even care if I got paid. And I really developed a second passion after football, and that was operating in the abdomen. It wasn't quite as sexy as neurosurgery or cardiac surgery, but bottom line is I loved it. Went on, decided to leave the Boston area, went to California, and began a surgery residency, which was wonderful. I never had so much fun in my life. I was well into my senior residency year when the operating room had become a real haven for me. Life was good. I'd gotten back on track, and I loved doing what I was doing. When I had an accident to my right hand, and I'm right-handed, and suddenly after many hours of surgery and many months in a cast, my right hand didn't function that well. The operating room, and that accident, by the way, had nothing to do with drinking or drugging. It was just an accident where a bowl exploded and cut my right wrist and right hand. And although the Department of Surgery at UCSD, where I was, told me they would keep me in doing research, and while I rehabbed my hand, after 9 months of rehab, I decided to try to go back into surgery. It was a foreign place to me now. I was afraid to go in there. And I got my first change of careers. I got a chance to go to Los Angeles. My hand was good enough to do emergency room work, and I started a 25-year emergency room career, which wasn't as much fun as surgery, but which offered me a second chance, because the operating room had become a very scary place to me, where I had been previously very good at surgery, and now I was afraid to be in there. Emergency medicine turned out to be interesting, wonderful in a lot of ways, also began my slow downfall. With lots of money, lots of time off, I developed habits where I would go to the finest bars, hung out in Beverly Hills, bars and restaurants that are well known, and began to drink too much. Would occasionally indulge in getting some opioids or some amphetamines. And although I could control it, I thought it slowly started to grab at me. So at that point, I met a man who was half owner of the Roxy and the Whiskey and the Rainbow, which are big nightclubs in on the Sunset Strip, and I began in a medical career of taking care of a lot of rock and roll stars. And over the next 10-15 years, I took care of some of the greatest, at least, rock and roll stars in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. Life seemed to be good. I had a home in La Jolla, California, moved down there, had wonderful cars, had four beautiful, wonderful children, all accomplished. Life seemed good on the outside, but alcohol and drugs were slowly eating away at me. And my career actually was doing pretty well. I had other doctors working for me. Life seemed good on the outside, but obviously something was wrong. I ballooned up to over 400 pounds. Ended up having in the early 90s one of the early gastric bypass surgeries, and that I really think I was supposed to stop drinking after that surgery. I did try to cut down. I found that I couldn't. I started to really get in trouble, and then with a you know, with a side issue of a little pain, I got hooked on Vicodin, and the combination of Vicodin and vodka eventually took me all the way down. So
okay, well, listen, let's stop right there for a moment. Unfortunately, okay, we've got to take a break, but stay tuned. We'll be right back with more interesting conversation with Dr. Skip.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
And now, back to Gwen Cardin on Break the Chains.
Welcome back. Today we're talking with Dr. Skip Sviocola, whose new book, From Harvard to Hell and Back, details his descent into drugs and alcohol and his ultimate redemption. Dr. Skip, right before the break, you mentioned that you had ballooned up to 400 pounds and had had gastric bypass surgery, and that had some definite influence on what happened to you next in terms of your addiction. So I'd love for you to continue a little bit with that part of your story.
Sure, terrific. Of note, it looks as though gastric bypass surgery, which is becoming more common, is really affecting a whole lot of people. I have contracts with the nursing board, the medical board here in California, I'm not in California anymore, in Rhode Island. And one of the things I do now when I get people in here is ask them when they had their gastric bypass surgery, and they look at me amazed. The number of people who are succumbing to addictions later in their life after gastric bypass is on the way up. But anyway, I'm living proof of that. I was not supposed to drink at all. I had lied to the psychiatrist who interviewed me prior to the surgery at Scripps Clinic, and then I said that I would be able to just not have anything to drink afterwards. Bottom line is, previous to the surgery, I could easily hold down 6, 7, or 8 double vodkas, and very, very few people ever even knew that I drank. I certainly did not act drunk. I never had a DUI, although God knows there were many nights that's the grace of God. But in any event, after the surgery, I tried to drink again, and I started to drink, and 2 or 3 doubles was the limit, and sometimes that amount of drinking would put me in a blackout. There was some post-op complications a little bit after the surgery. I was stabbed in the sciatic nerve by a nurse who was giving me an injection of antibiotics that gave me a pretty severe pain down my leg. And I had gotten back on Vicodin, which I had successfully gotten off of right after the surgery. And when I got the taste for that over the ensuing months, I After my doctors wouldn't give me any more and I didn't want to ask new doctors, I began to write my own prescriptions for it. And because I had good relationships with a lot of medical staff and nurses, I had this elaborate plan. Again, I was already deep into the addiction at this point, where I would send nurses and other people who would help me go get prescriptions under false name and bring it back to me. The bottom line is I had developed up the tolerance to get up to 150 Vicodin a day. And the reason I know I was taking 150 a day for the last 40 days was the district attorney of San Diego told me they had started to follow, and they'd been tipped off by some pharmacist and they kept an eye out. And I had been writing prescriptions and other names and then having them come back, and I would give them the money to go buy it, come back and bring it to me. And I remember that when I was driving home one day while I was at that terrible rate, I drove by my house in La Jolla, California. It wasn't quite a mansion, but it was a beautiful home near the water in La Jolla. It was certainly a mansion compared to what I live in now. And I saw three people standing at the door with my wife, and I can't remember if they were exactly in black, but metaphorically they sure were, and I was hoping they were Jehovah's Witnesses or somebody telling something, but they were in fact the Medical Board of California. I could tell by the pained look on my wife's face that something was up. She looked beyond them, looked at me. I stepped on the gas and took off and thought, well, the jig is up now. And I went and hid in the best hotel in La Jolla, California. It didn't take my wife long, a couple days to find me. I locked myself in a room, ordered the finest booze and the finest food, and I tried to wean myself off those 150 Vicodin a day. I probably had 100 left in my pocket. And I tried to do that by drinking. I was clearly a mess. I was disgusting. My wife finally found me. Actually called one of the psychiatrists that had dealt with me before, who I'd been lying to right along, had him come in and try to coax me out of the room. And he went out screaming, I can't help him. I was as finally my wife, with the help of some of my kids, got me home, and I had to face the music at the medical board. Medical board immediately suspended my license, eventually revoked it, and they told me I could reapply after a couple of years. Then the criminal authorities came in, and I could have gone to jail. We were able to plea bargain down fraudulent prescription writing, but I was scared to death I was going to go to jail. I wasn't afraid of much, but I didn't think jail was a good thing to do when you were 52 years old, or in any time for that matter. Mm-hmm. And my will fell apart. I had to sell my beautiful home in California. The IRS came and took it away, because although I was making about $500,000 a year, I was probably spending almost $1 million, and I hadn't paid my taxes in a couple of years. And I had wrecked my life because I was able to fake my prosperity for so long. I didn't drink or drug for about 3 months, and then I fell into a second cycle of addiction where I resumed drinking, and we had to leave our home in California. I had to go mooch off some of my children, who were kind enough to let us do that. My wife had to go back to work. We eventually ended up in Manhattan Beach, California, living in a very cheap one-bedroom apartment over a Bikram yoga studio, where it's very hot normally, and in California it was even hotter. It was a horrible place. My wife was working hard just to pay that little rent. We had lost everything, and I was essentially homeless. Technically, I could come into the house, but I just didn't. I was ashamed to come home, and she was working hard after not working for 30 years, and I was still drinking, running away, hiding, sleeping on the beach, and I was a total disgusting wreck. I looked like every classic picture of an alcohol-dependent person. I looked bad, I smelled bad, and I just wanted to die. I took up residence on the roof of that apartment that we lived in, and I would occasionally look over the edge and look down and think, I really like to end it all, but if I jump off this three-story roof, I'm just going to make matters worse. So I'd go back to sitting in the roof and drinking, and I began sort of, my salvation started creeping in when I would go to AA meetings and I would sit in the back of the room. They were very kind. As long as I shut my mouth and sat in the back of the room, I could watch and listen to people talk. And I would think over and over again, God, I'm just like these people. And, I couldn't figure out why I couldn't stop, but I knew I was just like those people. Well, as my life really degenerated, as I got to sleeping probably 30 minutes a day, I looked and smelled like every horrible alcoholic, and I know the misery, and I just wanted to die, but I was so deep into the alcoholism that when I would pass out, I might sleep for 30 or 40 minutes and then wake up and have to face another whole day ahead of me. And I just thought, this is hopeless. And I kept thinking, I've got to be able to figure this out. After all, I'm a smart guy, even though the evidence was all to the contrary. And I was staring at this bottle of pop-pop vodka on the roof. It was about half empty. Might still be up there, in fact. And I was trying hard to figure out, how can I control this? What can I do? How do I stop? When all of a sudden I had an insight. Now, a lot of people insist it's a spiritual moment, and I personally think it was, but I'm not so spiritually certain that I would project that. Maybe it was just I finally got as smart as I thought I was. But suddenly I had what I like to liken to an Escher print moment. You know, M.C. Escher does these wonderful prints where are the stairs heading up or down? Are the birds flying left or right? Are they blackbirds on a white background or whitebirds on a black background? You're looking at a print which has the same amount of information in it, but suddenly you see the opposite side. You know, you can see it one of two ways. And at that moment, something in my brain clicked, and it was as simple as, gee, you know what? I'm not like those alcoholics. I'm one of them. Now, that sounds ridiculously simple, and I do think that getting sober is sometimes too simple for smart people. And I suddenly went, wow, I got this. I know a whole bunch of alcoholics who are happy and living a life. And what do they have in common? They don't drink anymore. They stop trying to control it. So at that moment, December the 1st, 2000, I just never, the urge to drink left me. I knew I was in for a pretty bad detox. I climbed down off the roof, went and said to my wife, can I come inside tonight? I think I'm done. She said, I've heard that before. I said, you're just going to have to wait. I really think this is it, but, you know, I'm going to have to prove it to you. And I haven't had a drink since that day. The detox was bad. The climb back to get my license was horrendous. California was very punitive, and they had a right to be. It just seemed that they kept moving the goalposts. After I got sober and did everything I was supposed to do, they made it very difficult. And so then we decided to move back to Rhode Island, and I was able to come back. I still had to do everything I had left California with to get my license back in order for Rhode Island to honor me, but they didn't keep changing the rules, and I was able to get my license back. Then decided that I'd have a second chance in life of changing a career, and again, for the second time in my life, there was a new career beckoning. Emergency medicine had bailed me out the first time when I left surgery, and now addiction medicine was a brand new specialty, and I thought, look, I'm an addict by experience. I might as well be an addict by training, too. And so I studied hard when I got my license back, became board certified in addiction medicine, and now I love helping people getting better, hopefully before they're 52 years of age, the way it took me. So that's how it all went down. And now for the last a decade or so, I've been able to help a lot of folks. We use Suboxone in a recovery-based mode here to help people off opiate addiction, but we here in my office, we have contracts with most of the professional boards in the state of Rhode Island, and we help a lot of professional people get back and monitor them, and life is good again. I had been leading a horrible, horrible existence, a double life when I was taking the drugs and alcohol, and now honesty started to flood my life, and by God, it's a heck of a lot better, to be honest, something that never occurred to me until I got recovery.
Well, listen, we need to take another break right now, but we'll continue talking to Dr. Skip about his amazing life story in just a couple of minutes, so don't go away.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Welcome back to Break the Chains. Here again, your host, Gwen Cardin.
Before we resume, I'd like to remind you that I really do appreciate receiving feedback and ideas from listeners, and I would especially like to hear from you. So please take a couple of minutes after the show to email me your ideas and comments at addictionradioshow@gmail.com. We're talking today to Dr. Skip Sviokla about his very personal story that he details in his new book, From Harvard to Hell and Back. Dr. Skip, when I was reading your book over the weekend, I could not put it down. There were so many gritty details, and just trying to imagine going from being so wealthy and living such a high life to the depths to which you sank was really hard to put down. I'd like it if you could tell listeners just a little bit more about that really horrible time in your life, because I think it serves to show the wonderful contrast that we'll talk about a little bit later to what your life is today.
Sure. I initially was insulted. I don't know how I dared to be insulted, but was insulted when they took my license away. And like a lot of the patients I treat today, my first thought was, well, the heck with this. I don't want to be a doctor anymore anyway, which was really my withdrawal talking. And I thought, well, anybody will want a guy with a couple of Harvard degrees. Somehow I managed to be arrogant even then. I thought, I've lost everything, but I'm going to go and get a job because, after all, I'm smarter than anybody. Well, I found out that even though I tried to clean up a little bit before I started to drink again, and I went in and looked for many kinds of jobs, I never got a call back for the first time in my life. No one even would give me the time of day. I tried to get sales jobs. I tried to get administrative jobs. I tried to get any job that I could, and no one wanted me. That's when my wife realized that we were going to have no income. When the IRS forced the sale of our house, I had really run through all our savings, and you know, I had credit card bills of $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a month, and so we really were broke. And that's when we had to move in with my kids, and we were up in the Los Angeles area. I tried job after job. My first job was a guy in AA, because I had started to go to AA off and on, who allowed me to came up to me after a meeting and said, "Listen, I had spoken a little bit about my state," and he said, "Maybe I'm insulting you, but would you like to have a job chopping cilantro and onions in the kitchen of my restaurant? I'll have to pay a minimum wage, but you'll have something." And I was so grateful, I absolutely wept. I had never thought that I would want to take a job. I went to work for this guy for a little while. I did work hard, but frankly, the young guys next to me were a heck of a lot better at chopping than I was, and eventually he had to let me go. Then a little bit later, I had the audacity to apply for a job as a manager in a sandwich shop, Quiznos sandwich shop. And I was trying to control my drinking at that point. And I was able to do okay for a couple of weeks, but then I started to drink before I went to work in the morning. And one day I went in, it was all overwhelming, and I just left the place, locked it up. And when the owner tried to find me, he did get in touch with me a couple of days later, actually said, look, straighten yourself out, I'll give you a second shot, and I failed a second time at the Quiznos. I was distraught and devastated. My wife, working as a teacher's aide, struggling. We could barely afford any food, and we certainly had no luxuries. And any money that I could find that I would steal from her or from the liquor store got me to be stealing bottles. I can't tell you how many cold, freezing nights I slept on the beach or in a public toilet on the beaches of Southern California. So life was really horrible at that time. And, you know, tramping around, my family would come look for me. I must have put them to the tortures of hell. If I would see them, I would run away, and they would try to find me, but I had a lot of good hiding places. That is so different from when I get true recovery that it blows my mind. When I came back to Rhode Island, there were not a large number of people looking to hire me, but when I went to a couple of recovery places and said, look, I need to get my license back before I can become board certified in addiction medicine. So would you teach me recovery from the counseling side? I'm an old ER doc, used to seeing things, fixing them, and sending people out. Recovery is certainly a long-term business. And all of a sudden, doors opened to me. I found that the joy of my first job paid me $24,000 a year. And again, I was ecstatic. And this time, because I was sober, I was able to keep it. So,
what were you doing in that job?
I was an intake coordinator for a place called Meadows Edge. It's a recovery center, not unlike my own now, that's down the road from me in Rhode Island. The owner of that was a physician who hired me. He said, now listen, if I hire you and teach you all about addiction, will you go out and become my competition? And I looked at him and I said, well, honestly, that would be great. I would hope to be able to do that well. And he hired me anyway. And so I was in Rhode Island for about a year and a half before I actually got my license back, and then I had to get my DEA back. All that time I was learning from all the counselors about how to treat addiction, because doctors are relatively new to addiction treatment, and there's a pretty big clash among some doctors who always want to be at the top of the pyramid rather than part of the working team. And doctors need to understand where they are in addiction. If you're board certified in addiction medicine, doesn't mean you know anything about counseling. It just means you know about the medicine of addiction. And so I saw from the inside that no longer could I be the big boss the way I was of all the emergency rooms I worked at, but that I had to be part of a team, because most of the people working in recovery either were in recovery themselves or had been trained in a more counseling bent. And now this new addition of doctors who generally think they know it all, although I'd been humbled sufficiently to not think I knew it all, I was able to assume a better place. And so as I did learn about addiction and work with a bunch of counselors and work with a psychologist who used to do some assessment of people for their psychiatric needs in this clinic, I suddenly saw that I was really just a cog in the wheel, perhaps the hub of all the cogs, because ultimately a doctor who's running the clinic is ultimately responsible. But without the input from my counselors and from the psychologist that works for us, I would be at sea, because this was not, I didn't know it as well as they did, certainly from the counseling side.
So how were you staying sober during this period? What was keeping you straight?
I had a 5-year contract with the nursing board. The medical board. I'm sorry. I had already been sober for 3 or 4 years by the time I got back to Rhode Island. So, I had done that just because I quite frankly never had the urge after that moment on the roof. But I was going to AA meetings when I got back to Rhode Island. I didn't go to quite as many, but I had to go to a doctor's meeting of all doctors in recovery led by a psychiatrist. I had to submit to random urine screens, eight a month for the first year, 6 a month for the next 3 years, and 4 a month for the last year, and always had to show up, and they were always clean. I had to see a counselor who was a master's level guy in good recovery. And so my week was filled with a group meeting with doctors, occasional AA meetings, and urine screens to keep monitor me, and my counselor, a guy named Donald Coach, who to this day I see some, 13 years into my recovery. I remember the first time the medical board of Rhode Island said, you're going to have to get a counselor, and they picked this fellow. I guess I had gotten a little less humble at that moment. I said, well, I need a psychiatrist. I don't need a social worker. And they said, this is who you're going to go see. He's, we like him, and we hope you like him. I went to see him. I said, Donald, I'm sorry, but I really think I need a psychiatrist. He laughed and said, well, I guess you're stuck with me. And now, years after my contract is up, I see him once a week because as a guy who's sober a lot more years than I am, I can sit down and get a whole raft of recovery information from him every week. He's really been the thing that I've stayed with the longest. My practice now is allows me to see people who are coming in, still using, relapsing, and it serves as a constant reminder of how happy I am to be clean, how happy I am to put my pillow on my head on a pillow at night and go to sleep, and all the wonderful aspects of recovery that people don't even know about when they're using.
Let me ask you this. What was it like trying to repair the relationship that you had destroyed with your wife and your children?
Well, my children were standoffish. They were helpful. Interestingly enough, I'm sure they were very angry with me, but they never showed it to me so much. They unfortunately took it out on my wife because she was the stronger one of the two of us. She is not a drinker or a drugger by any means. She had been the strong person in a relationship. She certainly had gotten tired of me, and now, in retrospect, she said that she was getting near the end of her rope, and had I not walked in that night, we probably didn't have too much longer to go. We've now been married 45 years. She's really the hero in my story. She saved my life. But it was interesting. When I first started to, the first couple of days I didn't drink, I just laid low, was always where I'd say I'd be, didn't disappear into the street anymore. She'd go off to work. I would do what I could to make a little supper when she came home, or be a dutiful spouse. And I used to walk up to her and just plant a kiss on her cheek or neck. At first she was repulsed by me. I don't blame her, because we had long ago stopped being intimate as I turned into the disgusting individual I was at the time, or certainly acting in a disgusting way. She would flinch when I'd come over, and my whole point in doing that was just to get close enough to put a kiss on her neck or cheek so that she could smell me. I know that sounds crude, but I had been for so long thinking I could have a little sip of vodka in the morning and then go around all day trying to cover your mouth, and act as though you hadn't been drinking, that I just wanted her to know that I wasn't hiding anything anymore. You can, if you smell any alcohol in me, then I leave me. But right now, all I would do is go up and do that, and slowly, I began to do the things that people in recovery do. I told the truth. I met my commitments, and these are things that for years I hadn't done. But I could always lord the money and the good times over it. And now the simple things were magical. As my counselor tells me today, after 45 years, neither one of us is getting out of this alive. So occasionally, I will go home. I must say that she doesn't doubt that I'm sober anymore, but, I've got a, I've got a few years yet to repay her, and she reminds me every now and then. So, but we're doing wonderfully well. We've had 8 grandchildren we love. We travel to see them, and it's and she's been wonderful.
Oh, well, that's great. Well, listen, it's that time again when we have to take a quick break from the show, but stay tuned and we'll be right back.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
You're listening to Break the Chains, America's top radio source of information for people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction. Here's your host, Gwen Cardin.
Before we resume talking to Dr. Skip, I want to invite you to go to our Facebook page and like us. You can find it at www.facebook.com/breakthechains1. Dr. Skip, we are in the last part of our hour. I'd like to know, is there anything you'd like to finish telling us about your own story? And then I would appreciate very much if you could share some of the knowledge that you've learned both through your own personal experience and your profession that might help other people who are going through addiction challenges.
Yes, I can. I think that the beginning of my joy started in California when my first grandchild was born. Each of my 4 children, who are all doing well now, certainly saw me impaired and saw me disgusted, and they will each, report now how, it wasn't quite as bad as I try to make it out, and they're being kind. But the bottom line is they all suffered somewhat from my, quite a bit from my addiction. When my first grandson was born, which is after I got sober, I remember, by then, people were happy I weren't drinking anymore, but when I would come to see Liam, my firstborn grandson, and I love all 8 of them now as I love Liam, but Liam happened to be in the right place at the right time, I would go over and I would volunteer to take care of Liam. And since I wasn't drinking anymore, people were happy to have me do that. And besides, nobody really wanted to see me come over. They were glad I wasn't drinking anymore, but I wasn't getting work. I wasn't getting my license back. And, yeah, they were glad I was alive, but I wasn't a heck of a lot of fun. I couldn't even take them out for a hamburger. Liam didn't realize that, and Liam had never seen me impaired, and Liam was only about 10, 11 months old when I started to become the regular babysitter for him. So the only thing I could do was let my family go out and have fun without me. And little Liam, God love him, when Pop was coming over, would sometimes stand in the window of their home in Redondo Beach, California. And when I would pull up, he would actually do pirouettes. He would go round and round and say, "Yay, Pop is here." At that moment, nobody else wanted to see me but Liam. And now that he's 11 years old, he and I have an ongoing relationship about, and I invite him to come see me and talk about this. And he's a little young, perhaps, but we've been talking about addiction and drinking for quite a while. It's funny because as he got older and as he noticed that I never drank, he started giving his parents hell for drinking, and they're social drinkers. And I had to pull him aside and say, wait a minute. It's okay for them to drink. That's not the reason I don't drink. And I'll never forget the look on my daughter's face, like, my son is now telling me not to drink because you don't drink. I said, well,
you've had an amazing, amazing life. Is there anything in these last 5 minutes that we have on the show that you would like to share with other people that you have learned from both your own experience and perhaps from your professional career?
Yes, I think that one of the key things that I learned by experience is that surrender in this war against drugs and alcohol, well known to people in 12-step programs, but surrender, which can scare so many people away, is really the key to victory in this illness. It's the only surrender that isn't really a ceasefire. You actually begin to heal and get better. The attempt to try to control the use is something that we all do on our way down into the descent of our addiction. And we think we don't really have to stop. We just have to stop a little bit or try to control it. And I certainly did that for the last year of my active life. And it was that moment which made me realize I wasn't like those alcoholics. I was one of them. In retrospect, looking at it, that was really a surrender to the power of the alcohol. I thought, I just have to stop doing it. I can't stop. I've got to stop trying. And then everything became clear. If I had one question to ask a strange or a new patient to try to determine whether or not they understood recovery, I would simply say, discuss surrender. There are so many people who can talk the talk about surrender because they've been in and out of rehab and in and out of treatment. They will give you the right words, but there's something magical, at least in my experience of talking to people who have surrendered, where they light up, and you really can't shut them up about surrender, because like me, they have in one form or another, by their own way, actually seen the light and decided, you know what, I can live life without the drug, I can live life without the alcohol, and it's just wonderful. And so I really think that surrender is the only surrender which wins the war. Now, granted, it doesn't stop you from relapsing, but it certainly gets you over the hump and gets you starting to get better and fill your life with all the good things that have been gone for so long because you've driven them all away. So I really think that not trying to control the illness, accepting the fact that the drugs and alcohol are going to win and that you're not, I hope that we can somehow, talk some people into surrendering a little bit earlier. And if they will just try a little surrender, I think it'll grab them and help them the way it helped me. I don't think you can be too stupid to get sober, but I sure as hell think you can be too smart. And frankly, the next little handbook I'm writing is going to be entitled Too Simple for Smart People, because I do know, and since I deal with a lot of professionals now who are still fighting addiction, I want to shake them, and I do actually say to them, look, will you just let go of all this stuff? The wonderful paradox of this illness is that if you give up, you will win, and I think that's the main message I want. Plus the joy of the growth that you do when you feel your life, whether it's with religion for some people or family for others or a combination of all the good things you threw away, brings you a joy which I don't think that people understand is lying out there. When we're using and trying to stop, and I have certainly checked with many of my colleagues on this who are in recovery, somehow we begin to think that being normal is just boring. I'm Sure, that's due to our impaired thinking while we're using. We think, why do I want to go through all this pain and anguish to look like that normal couple walking over there, family, children, smiling, car, home? That's so boring. And many, many people, we think our dopamine, which is the main culprit, I think, in this illness medically, certainly one of the big ones, our dopamine is special. We don't want to be normal. Normal is boring. Why the hell should I stop this? As bad as this is, I don't want to be boring. Well, I don't want to be normal. Well, I'm here to say that normal is wonderful, and I never even knew what normal was until I get into recovery, because my idea of what normal was living high and living fast, and because everything came easy to me, and because I made a lot of bad decisions. It's a medical illness for sure. There are aspects of the brain chemistry that make people really, it's a medical illness, but damn it, it's a medical illness that we make a lot of bad decisions on before we climb down that ladder into hell. So I'm for taking responsibility, but when you finally do, and when you finally surrender in this war, life is so good you can't stand it.
Well, and I think people, when they are intelligent, sometimes are less likely to surrender because they think, as you did, that, you know, those are those other people I know better. I can figure this out on my own. So being intelligent can be a plus or definitely a minus when it comes to sobriety.
Yes, and I'm afraid my arrogance got in the way for so long. I was so blinded by it that I hope people can take a little lesson from the cocky jerk doctor who lost it all, even though it looked like he was doing fine.
Well, you certainly are honest, and I tell you, anyone who reads your book is going to be very, very very heartwarming story that you tell, and because of your honesty, I think many of us don't look at ourselves in quite that way, and yet that seems to be the real key to truly becoming happy and becoming your authentic self.
Well, Gwen, thank you. You've been very kind to have me on. I really appreciate it. It's always an honor to be able to talk about this awful illness. I thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate very much, too. As I say, you're very candid. Your story is very compelling. And I love a happy ending, so that's always better as well. Dr. Skip, would you let our listeners know how they can learn more about you and your book?
Well, they can go on my website, which is medicalassistedrecovery.com, and they can, of course, get it on Amazon. They can get it on iTunes. Any number of electronic outlets will have it. Barnes & Noble carries it. But going to my website, medicalassistedrecovery.com, which is the name of my clinic, we have blogs, videos, and a whole bunch of stuff. And I would encourage people to contact me on the website. I'd be more than happy to talk to anybody at any time about their addiction.
Right. And the book is called From Harvard to Hell and Back.
He's a great co-author, by the way. I should show him Kerry Zookas. He's written 45 books, and he helped make that story readable.
Yes, he did. Well, the very first page just grabbed me. So, and then the rest of the book did not disappoint. I also want to add that people can find a little bit more information about you on my Talk Zone show page, and also they can contact me through the Talk Zone show page. Be sure to tune in to Break the Chains next week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, when our guest will be author and psychotherapist Dr. Alan Berger, and he'll be talking about his latest book, The Hidden Rewards of Making Amends. You won't want to miss it. For now, this is your host, Gwen Carden. Be safe, live smart, and most of all, take good care of yourself.